Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Angeli. This hour on the program, United States ally Turkey wants to join the European Union. My guest this hour, historian Kemal Karpat, says that Turkey's journey to Europe has been a long one, but he says it's not yet over. The leaders of France and Germany in particular oppose Turkey's entrance into the EU. The Republic of Turkey, population of more than 70 million, it's a secular democracy which is now seeing a power struggle between a moderately Islamist governing party and more secular power elites. The Turkish government has been helpful to the United States in the war against Iraq, so it has some considerable influence with the Bush administration. Turkey's opposition to a congressional resolution condemning the Armenian genocide, that resolution attempted last fall, it helped thwart that resolution. It was never enacted. We'll find out more about Turkey, which my guest says is probably the only nation to have turned modernity into their national religion and Islam into the source of their individual spiritual faith. Kemal Karpat is a Turkish historian and professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His current book is The Politicization of Islam. And my guest speaks today in Columbus. We'll tell you more about that. Welcome, Kemal Karpat. Good to have you here this morning.
Thank you. Nice to be in Columbus.
Well, we're glad to have you here. We're at 614-292-8513. If you'd like to join our conversation by phone, you can email questions to openline at WOSU.org. Well, Turkey would very much like to be a part of the European Union, but there's some opposition to, particularly with the leaders of France and Germany, I think has been noted, to Turkey becoming a member of the European Union. Why the opposition? Is there some prejudice against Turkey because 99% of the population is Muslim? Are there other reasons? What's wrong?
Fundamentally, I think it's a opposition born from cultural, religious, and historical reasons. For a long time, Turkey, as represented by its predecessor, Ottoman Empire, was considered a menace to Europe. Ottoman armies advanced all the way to Vienna, and they threatened the rest of West Europe. That was something which ended in the 17th century, but the perception that somehow Turks are a menace to Europe has remained. And in those days, the menace was defined not in political terms, but religious terms. Turks were alien. They were Muslims. But nobody really bothered at the time to ask what Muslim was, you know. Muslim was the enemy. And that image has remained, not only in relation to Turkey, but when suitable against other Muslims in Europe. I say suitable because at one time, France and England had occupied major part of the Muslim world, and they were trying to become friendly with the Muslim countries. At the time, they played down the religious differences. But now, again, these differences have come to the surface as waves of immigrants from Muslim countries, along with other countries, settled in Europe. And Turks are among the main ones, particularly in Germany.
So there's a bit of a stereotype here.
It's a stereotype, but behind it there are demographic and economic reasons. Economic reason is that a good part of the labor force in Germany, for instance, is made up of Turks. Approximately 3 to 3.5 million Turks live in Germany, some legally, some illegally. At least half of them nowadays seem German citizens. As the labor market becomes a little bit tight and Germans out of work, they tend to put the blame on Turks. So you have an economic reason there. Demographic reason, Turks and Germany increase much faster than the German population, which is aging and decreasing. So there's a demographic fear there that at one time in the future, the Turks may become far more numerous than they are today and may play much greater part in German political life than is the case. I think all these fears are certainly overblown because according to my estimates, the growth of the Turkish population in Germany will stop probably around 5 million or so. But then the other thing is that Germany needs young labor force. Where do they have to get it? If not from Turkey, then from Russia or Poland or elsewhere. So, well, anyway, all these reasons put together amount to opposition to Turkey's entry into the European Union. But then a great number of Turks are no longer interested in becoming members of the European Union.
No longer. They were really hot on doing this for a great while, were they not? But that's changed.
Well, the entry is being clobbered with so many conditions and then so many insults in the European press to the end that the Turks said, we are going to enter the European Union as a pariah. Better not. Well, Turks are fundamentally proud people, you know, big history behind them, certain achievements, civilization, the Ottoman civilization, and so on. And they don't like to be treated as third-class citizens. So there is a question of national pride. And some say, well, we have survived until now without being a member of the European Union. We'll do it in the future, too.
Historian Kamal Karpat is with us, Professor Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're learning more about a major U.S. ally, Turkey. We're at 614-292-8513. My guest, by the way, will deliver a lecture which is entitled Jews and Turks, Model of Coexistence. It'll discuss the relationship between the Turkish Muslim population, the great majority, and the Jewish population in Turkey. And it's sponsored here by the Sauda Education Foundation and also by the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity and Students for Dialogue at OSU. The lecture is this afternoon at 5:30, late in the afternoon. Located on campus at the Dries Lab, 113, room 113, Dries Lab on the OSU campus. There's parking in the Tuttle Park Place garage, we should note. 5:30 this afternoon in the Dries Lab, room 113. We're at 614-292-8513. Kamal, help us understand. It's a 99.9% Muslim population in Turkey, but it is avowedly a secular state. I mean, with a democratically elected government, a parliament, a president, a prime minister, and Turks seem to be at pains to make sure to preserve that secularism. What do they mean by secularism?
Well, it's probably one of the most complex issues, both for Turks and for outsiders to understand. First of all, let me put that there are two forms of secularism. There is the French secularism, the laïcité, as they call it, which sees somewhat of a contradiction between faith and science. And then there is the second model, the Anglo-Saxon American model, whereby the two coexist, science and faith. Now, Turkey fits historically between the two. In the early days of the Ottoman Empire, and I mean the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, there was a de facto separation between faith and state. Each one was headed by its respective leaders. Then in the 17th century, as the state weakened and began to feel the need for popular support, it began to utilize the faith to strengthen its own political position. In other words, there was a politicization of the faith via the state, whereas in the past the two were separated. Then in the 19th century, there began secularization. Secularism and secularization are two distinct concepts. In the Turkish context, secularization means worldly, to become more aware of the living world around you, of the living society, its needs and changing needs. And that began in the 19th century under so-called caliphs, that is sultans, who also had the title of caliph. Head, caliph means the head of the Muslim community. And this is how the country came to the 20th century. And then secularism was turned into a more formal separation. Science, modernity took precedence, and the Republic was identified with science and modernity, and eventually, especially after the death of Atatürk in 1938, secularism began to acquire positivist, materialistic forms as being opposed to faith. Although laws, the constitution, and everything else never excluded religion, yet in the eyes of a leading elite, somewhat faith and science were considered irreconcilable. Well, faith was represented by Islam, secularism was represented by religion. And this separation took the form of positivism in the late 30s and 40s. And then there came democracy. And it was a basic principle of democracy that faith was among the most basic rights. So people said, we want to have also freedom of faith, not to establish an Islamic government. That has never been a question in Turkey. The question of secularism in Turkey has always revolved around the right to believe as part of democratic rights. But there's always been, as in any country in the world, a small group which has turned secularism into an ideology and made it the ideology of power, that is, of their own power, to take any kind of pretext, religious pretext, as a form of excuse to limit religious freedoms. And this is where we are now. But the whole issue has become so intermingled with politics that you really need special background to understand what's going on.
But the basic premise is that, that Turkey is dedicated to being a secular state, which enables freedom of religion.
Yeah.
but a secular constitution, a secular government, a modern government that seeks to enter the European Union and at the same time preserve religious freedom.
Yes. Basically, in Turkey, 90% of the population, although good believers, Muslims, are secular. They believe in a secular government, secular society. Maybe 5, 10%, like in any country, are ultra-religious.
So they don't, the great majority of churches.
They don't, Matt. In the last two elections, a party, Refah Party, which is identified with political Islam, received only 2.5% of the total vote. But of the middle of the road party, the one which considers Islam part of the basic democratic rights, that party is in government. In the last elections of last July, it received 47% of the vote. Although the individual leaders of the party are good observant Muslims, as a whole, the party declared itself to be secular, democratic, ready to join the European Union, modernist, and so on. And everything this party has been doing for the past 5 years tends to back its claims. Indeed, in the last 5 years, on the so-called Islamist government, Turkey saw the largest dose of democratization, a change in the laws concerning freedoms. The state never took any major measure to support Islamism and so on. Of course, there were a few points, as usual. But fundamentally, the so-called Islamist government of Turkey for the past year has undertaken the most modernist, most pro-European and secularist policy ever undertaken by any government in Turkey. But you still have a small group which sees in every act of a government a defiance of secularism and something, a road leading to Islamist government, which is absurd in my estimation. For somebody who has studied for 50 years Turkish politics, I don't agree with this agreement, with this argument. Of course, the government has made some gross errors, tactical errors, such as the wearing of the turban, the head cover. They declared it to be a question of basic rights that people should be allowed to wear whatever they please. But instead of leaving the matter to time, they passed a law or amendment to the Constitution whereby they were legalizing the wearing of the so-called turban, which, in my estimation, was an unnecessary measure. But that helped stoke the fires of anti-government. So right now there is a case before the court, the Supreme Court, aiming at disbanding the party in power.
In other words, this is the party in power, the party that got 47% of the vote, AKP, I think they're called, is the acronym. And there's a measure before the High Court in Turkey saying, look, we want to disband this party and prohibit the major political figures, which would include the president and the prime minister of Turkey now, from being involved in politics in 5 years. And that's before the court now. And I think those who within Europe and the European Union are taking a look at this are saying, you better resolve this without disbanding any parties, because if you disband the governing party, that means you're not responding to the democratic poll of the electorate who gave them 47% of the vote.
You're absolutely right. The party which was elected with a huge popular vote, only 8 or 9 months ago, is faced with a judiciary coup, a case brought before the Supreme Court accusing the party of anti-secularist measures. Some are totally insignificant pieces of paper. Really, the indictment includes news clipped from newspapers indicating that the government somehow was anti-secularist.
And you feel that's not true. Well, come on, how is this going to end? In other words, if you have the major party, a case in the court is attempting to disband the party, and the European Union says this is not acceptable, you cannot enter the European Union if these kind of anti-democratic court procedures are going to go on. Where is this going to end up?
Well, I am rather pessimistic. The forces pushing for the closure of the party based on this flimsy argument is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
They may prevail and close the party, which may lead to new elections, which means re-election of this party, maybe under a different name.
Under a different name, yeah.
Just a repeat of something which has been occurring in 15 years. Obviously, for anybody who is serious about establishing a true democratic regime in Turkey, such measures are very discouraging, you know. The people of Turkey, the overwhelming majority of people, are democratic, are ready for democracy, and look forward to an era of development. I mean, Turkey is in need of economic development.
But come on, you're saying that, in other words, the AKP party, 47% of the vote in the last election, you think its opponents, who must be extreme secularists, are going to prevail here and disband the party. Then you're going to have a new election, and the same prime minister and the same president are going to be reelected, and the same parliamentary majority, because the party has that, are going to be reelected under another name.
Yes, except that in the case before the Supreme Court, some 71 politicians are named. And they will be prevented from engaging in politics for 5 years, which leaves the prime minister outside.
Ah, so the prime minister will not be able to run. The president will not be able to run.
Frankly, it doesn't make sense. If you use democratic criteria, what is happening in Turkey is totally undemocratic, unacceptable, both to Turks and non-Turks.
It sounds like if this really happens, it's going to scotch any possibility of Turkey getting into the European Union if they really go through with this.
But one of the aims of the people behind this case before the Supreme Court is exactly that, to prevent the entry of Turkey into the European Union so that Turkey will be ruled by the same clique that had been ruling Turkey behind the scene for the past 50, 60 years.
The whole thing is a power play. It has nothing to do with secular versus Islamic. It's got nothing to do with that, you're saying.
You are absolutely right.
Power play. Okay.
All these big name concepts, secularism, this or that, modernism, Atatürkism, these are pretexts or shields that cover minor interests of small groups which have been so accustomed to hold power that they no longer wish to pass it on to others. And they are prepared to utilize any means whatsoever.
My guest, Kemal Karpat, is a Turkish historian, professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His current book is The Politicization of Islam. Callers, hang right on the line. We're going to get to you after we pause for these messages at WOSU 820. NPR News.
next time on Day to Day.
Do you want environmentally friendly food?
Michael Pollan will tell you what to plant.
We've got peas, chard, beets.
And what to buy.
There's a way to navigate the supermarket where you'll end up with some decent food.
So what's that in his refrigerator?
I mean, I'm not a fanatic. You'll also find there's spray whipped cream.
Saving the planet while saving your sanity.
Next time on Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in just about 30 minutes at noon, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Sunny skies today, a high around 80 expected this afternoon. Be sure to tune into WOSU-TV tonight at 8 o'clock for Chefs in the City. You'll see 8 notable local chefs preparing some of their signature dishes, along with cooking demonstrations from nationally renowned chef Joanne Weir. That's this year's Chefs in the City. It's tonight at 8 o'clock on WOSU-TV. And you're listening to Open Line with Fred Anderle. You can listen to Open Line where you want and when you want with the Open Line podcast. Search Open Line at the iTunes Music Store to download each program to your iPod or MP3 device. And taking a look at the forecast for today, sunny skies, a high around 80. Clear tonight, a low of 55. Partly sunny on Friday, a chance of a shower, maybe a thunderstorm, and a high of 78. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. We're learning more about a big U.S. ally, Turkey, and Turkey wants to join the European Union, this secular democracy. More than 70 million people now. We're hearing about some political struggles going on in Turkey now. And my guest, Kemal Karpat, is a Turkish historian, professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My guest's current book, The Politicization of Islam. We're at 614-292-8513. Also, if you'd like to, you can email us at openline@wosu.org. Here's Bill on the line. Hi, Bill. You're with us.
Yes, and my name is Abdul, and my question to the guest is, since the Europeans, they don't want to admit it and to Turkey, and they humiliated and disrespected them, why Turkey didn't organize their own backyard, which they have high-tech, Israel, and also those Soviet Union countries, Armenia and Azerbaijan, all those former Soviet Union, which are democratic countries now, and from their own community, which can lead them to a superpower country also with their allies from the United States, and they can do better. Even though the last argument, the last comment you say was that there is a group of people who are holding the Turkey outside of the European common market for their own interest, which I didn't know before, but I thought it was the Europeans who were discriminating. But why Turkey didn't create their own market, and including Israel, those Arab Muslim countries, and that can diffuse the whole situation in that Middle East situation?
All right, let's get an answer. Kemal, in other words, a caller wants to know, he says, look, if the European Union is so chary about admitting Turkey, and is giving Turkey so much trouble, there's a region there around which Turkey could organize, including the State of Israel and other. What do you think of that?
Well, this is an argument which is made also in Turkey by Turks who no longer are interested in the European Union. But the tragic part of this whole business is that Turkey is already half, more than half, in the European Union, because Turkey is part of NATO, has been part of NATO since 1952. It's joined practically every other European organization. De facto, Turkish ties to Europe are almost 90% of the ties with the foreign countries. So that's one thing.
So in that sense, it makes logical sense because of all of these ties to join the European Union.
Yeah. You can't break all those ties and then turn to Russia, to other countries with which Turkey has had rather rough relations in the past. Knowing the Russian ambitions in the past, it is very hard for Turkey to join with Russia. As far as Azerbaijan is concerned, relations with Azerbaijan are excellent. After all, the Azeris speak the same language, share the same culture. So there is not much that Azerbaijan can add to the existing relations or to the strength of Turkey. The same is true for other countries in the region. Turkey has good relations now with the Arab countries, and I don't believe that the Arab countries can contribute much to Turkish security. Mm-hmm. Economically speaking, the relations are developing. What Dubai, Saudi Arabia, and so on, they have always been relatively good. So I don't think that one can add more to the existing status quo as far as the relations of Turkey with the other countries in the Middle East are concerned. Relations with Israel is being also good.
All right.
So the thing is that if Turkey is not admitted into the European Union, and nobody expects that to happen, at least until 2015, Turkey can't stand by its sovereign, but remains isolated. However, its friendly relations with Europe and the rest of the Middle East will continue.
They will continue. Kale, thank you. Kamal, let me ask you this. Recently, Turkish troops made an incursion into Iraq to chase some Kurdish forces or militias that the government of Turkey regards as terrorists. And they incurred a few miles into Iraq with the agreement of the United States to do this, to pursue them. For those of us who we don't know a great deal about Turkey, in southeastern Turkey, there's a Kurdish minority. And I guess some of those Kurds in Turkey would like to establish an independent state, I understand. Of course, understandably, the government of Turkey doesn't want to allow this, but can you give us the picture of what would encourage Turkey to go across the Iraq borders in pursuit of people who have indeed entered Turkey themselves and fired upon and killed Turkish troops? What's this all about?
Well, there are two kinds of Kurds in Turkey. Roughly, there are about 12 to 14 million Kurds in Turkey. Of these, probably 60% or even more have emigrated out of eastern Turkey where they traditionally lived and settled in various cities in Western Europe. I mean, Western Turkey. Istanbul's got probably 1 million Kurds. As such, the Kurds of Turkey have developed as a different kind of Kurds, different from those in Iraq. They're better educated, more modernized, and I would say an overwhelming majority of them want to remain part of Turkey as Turkish citizens, but preserving their culture and language. In the last elections, last year, the Kurds, or the population in the so-called Kurdish parts of Turkey, voted in favor of candidates of the Justice and Development Party. The Kurdish party in that area received fewer votes than the main party which represents Turkey as a whole, the party which is in power.
The Justice Development Party, also called the AKP, is that right? The people
that's
we were
correct.
Talking about now who are the major, they've got the prime minister, they've got the majority in parliament, they've got the presidency. So you're saying the majority of Kurds voted in favor of them.
That's election.
Well, you say the Kurdish people in southwestern Turkey are modernized. There may be a million in the city of Istanbul. What about in southeastern in Turkey? Is there poverty there? Or are they a minority who've been neglected?
It's a less developed part of the country. It has been neglected, not only the Kurdish areas, but others. After all, Turkey does not have immense sources of capital to invest. But now, And this government in power in the last 4 or 5 years has initiated a number of reforms in the area which have turned to the benefit of the local Kurdish population, and this is why they are back in the present government. Then there is a small group, ultra-nationalists, that form the backbone of the PKK, the Marxist Labour Party, which had been active as a rebel force in Turkey until it was defeated, took refuge first in Syria and then in Iraq. There is a small portion in northern Iraq controlled by the PKK. The Kurdish administration in northern Iraq does not have control over this little area. So they would like to establish control over this area controlled by the Turkish Kurdish PKK. They are well entrenched there, the fortifications, deposit of ammunition, etc.
So when you say ammunition deposits, do you mean and fortifications? You mean in northern Iraq, or do you mean somehow within Turkey?
No, it's in northern Iraq.
In northern Iraq, yeah.
They do have some bases in southern Turkey, but they don't control them physically.
Mm-hmm. So they would like to, now the PKK in northern Iraq then would like to extend their influence into the sovereign nation of Turkey, and would they like to annex that territory from Turkey
or what? Their ultimate goal is to have an independent or at least autonomous portion there named Kurdistan, which eventually might link itself to the Kurdish area in Iraq. However, there's a fundamental difference between the PKK in Iraq and the Turks and the Kurds in Turkey, and the Kurds of Talabani and Barzani in Iraq, because these are Marxists, and they would like to establish a Marxist regime also in the parts controlled by Barzani and Talabani, and this is what the Iraqi Kurds don't want. So the PKK is really pressed on both parts by the Kurds of Iraq and the government of Turkey.
So the government of Turkey is attempting to, in southeastern Turkey, the part that is more poor, I believe the government of Turkey has given them now their own television, Kurdish television channel, which they didn't have before. They've been asking for that for some time. Also economic development and hydroelectric power, et cetera, projects in an attempt to gain their support for remaining fully part of Turkey.
Yes, and that policy is gaining ground, not only by having the Kurdish population back the current government, but also their attitudes toward the rest of Turkey have changed drastically. The other thing that needs to be stressed is the fact that physically speaking, looking at a Turk and a Kurd, you don't see much difference. Family laws, ways of life, and so on in Turkey are very much identical. I mean, Kurds and Turks. It's impossible to distinguish a Kurd in Istanbul from a Turk in Istanbul. The other thing is there is a huge number of deputies in the parliament who are of Kurdish origin and who are not affiliated with the Kurdish party. There are many, many officers in the army of Turkey of Kurdish origin, lots of very rich businessmen of Kurdish origin in Istanbul and other cities and so on. So there's an extraordinary mix of Kurdish and Turkish populations.
So, come on, let me ask you this. How threatened, then, does the government of Turkey feel by these PKK forces in northern Iraq? I mean, is Turkey, we've heard just news reports that Turkey has considered invading northern Iraq in the case of any disorder there, in order to to clean out this nest of people that they regard at least as enemies. I mean, is this a possibility?
Well, the only way the PKK can gather attention and support is to be active, to show a presence. And the only way they can show that presence is by terror. Certainly there are accumulated grievances from the past when the Kurds were badly treated. There's no question about that. There's poverty, all this. But none of them are strong enough to give PKK the big popular support it wants. On the other hand, underlining all the developments, there is an intangible support for the PKK simply because they are Kurds. The natural kind of sympathy you feel for your kin. So the Turks are caught between these winds. On the other hand, they want to gain the support of the Kurdish population and are gaining it. But on the other one, they want to keep and check the PKK, because the more terror PKK commits, the more publicity it gets.
Is there any danger of danger certainly from the United States point of view and maybe from the Kurds' point of view, of Turkey at some point invading northern Iraq in force to eliminate what they see as a threat?
Well, they have already invaded several times.
For short periods of time, yeah.
Short periods. Yeah. And there's always the possibility that they may do it again in the future. But until now, at least the latest incursions have occurred with the approval of the United States.
So far, yeah.
So far. I don't know. I mean, politics change so sudden and in unforeseen ways that one really can't venture a guess. But I might say that maybe at some point Turkey may ask to play a greater military role in the Iraqi war than is the case now.
Well, let me ask you, first of all, let me reintroduce my guest. Kamal Karpat is a Turkish historian, professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My guest's current book, The Politicization of Islam. Dr. Karpat will deliver a lecture entitled Jews and Turks, a Model of Coexistence. That's this afternoon, discussing the relationship between the Turkish Muslim population and the Jewish population in Turkey. And that event is sponsored by the Sciota Educational Foundation, co-sponsored by the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, and Students for Dialogue at OSU. I want to tell you when and where it is. It's at 5:30 this afternoon. Dr. Kamal Karpat. It'll be in Drees Lab, that's Dreese Lab, at room 113 right on the OSU campus. And you can park, I understand, in the Tuttle Park Garage. And we're at 614-292-8513. We have a question as an email here. Some say, says our emailer, Turkey is a good example for other countries in the Middle East, but some Muslims, says our emailer, do not agree. Does the professor think Turkey is an example for the region? It's not clear from our questioner's question what kind of an example he's talking about, but I would imagine the idea that we have here a successful democracy, which is a Muslim country, and with almost full participation by the people. Good example?
Yes, it's a very good question that's been asked several times in different forms. The question to be amplified for this simply. Turkey is a Muslim country and it has achieved a degree of democracy, proving thus that Islam and democracy are reconcilable. Because lots of people have argued that Islam as a religion is not suitable to democracy. Now, as a student of politics and religion, I could say no religion is suitable to democracy because every monotheistic religion believes that everything is ordered by God, and one cannot change God's word in very, very basic terms. In a way, democracy, via secularism in the West, has tried to go away from this, saying, in effect, that man should be allowed to decide his own, her own destiny. That's what it is. So it is absurd to say Islam is suitable to democracy or not suitable to democracy. But if you want to look at it in a more formal terms, you can say that Islam actually does have a number of institutions and practices conducive to democracy, which may not exist in other religions the same way. It has the shura, means council, debate. That's very much part of Islamic tradition. Mashwaret, which means consultation, conversation, ijma, opinion, that everything in this community should abide by the opinion of the wise man, ijma. Well, these are all practices in Islam that are conducive to democracy. But I think democracy comes really from the interplay of forces, laws, and interests in a specific country. In that respect, Turkey came to grips with reality and accepted that a progressive modern society cannot exist without democracy, without the input of the majority of the people who live in that country. So in this respect, Turkey has proven that Islam and democracy are reconcilable. Can Turkey be an example or not? No country is an example. A country offers only a yardstick for comparison. They have done it this way, we'll do it this way, but in a different fashion, our way. This is one thing, but there are other things which is often overlooked both by Turks and non-Turks. For several hundred years, Turkey was the leader of the Islamic world. Yes, was the leader of the Islamic world and defender of the Islamic world. As such, they gained the respect of many other Muslims. And finally, when Mustafa Kemal Atatürk undertook the liberalization of the country, based on popular support, and threw out the Italians, French, Greeks, and English out of the country in 1919-22, they won again the respect of the rest of the Islamic world as freedom's fighters. They liberated. So they do have certain claim to respectability coming from their history. And the Muslim world in general is aware of this. So whatever happens to Turkey, or whatever Turkey does, may not become a model, but may have a degree of impact upon the rest of the Islamic world.
All right. We have just a few more minutes here with Kamal Karpat, a historian, and Anne has a question on the telephone. Hello, Anne.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my question. Mm-hmm. And I find the professor's comments very interesting. I hope you have him back again.
All right.
My issue happens to be the question of why is it that the Islamic world tolerates the terrorist faction? A group of us were talking one evening, and someone said, well, you know, they should take care of it. And I said, well, over there, if you show dissent, and the terrorists are aware of it, they just wipe out your entire family. And I'm not speaking of Turkey, I'm speaking of the Islamic world. Since the terrorists are such a very small faction of Islam, why is it that the Middle East hasn't been able to, or what, maybe it is a matter of not wanting to, address the issue of the terrorists up until this time?
All right, let's, and we have just a minute here. Kamal, this may apply to Turkey in a certain sense, in that a suicide bomber was arrested just the other day in Turkey by authorities, not the first suicide bomber to be arrested in Turkey. So there have been incidents. And our caller seems to suggest that Islam should be better able to ferret these people out and somehow end the situation. What would you say?
Well, first of all, the main point here is that Islamic terrorists who claim to be fighting for Islam are a very, very tiny minority everywhere in the Islamic world. Secondly, everywhere they are illegal and do not have government or popular support. If there is a little bit of support, is when the terrorists identify themselves with national causes, which they often do. Whether it is an infringement upon the sovereignty of the country, or it is some sort of invasion that they protest in the name of Islam. But these are vague nuances of support. Fundamentally, there is no support. In fact, just the other day, I read news about the head of the Al-Hazar. Al-Hazar is the main Muslim office in Egypt. In fact, in the Muslim world, it has an enormous influence. The head of Al-Hazar condemned terrorism in very, very clear terms. Secondly, the sufferer of terrorism are actually the Muslims and the Muslim countries in which such acts occur. I'm not speaking of Iraq. I mean, there are other questions involved. But Pakistan, and finally, as you mentioned, Turkey. I mean, Turkey has been subject to so many acts of terror, and some of them on the part of ultra-Islamists who are protesting this government, which other secularists are protesting as being Islamic. The Islamics attack it as being un-Islamic, and secularists attack as being Islamic. So terrorism in the Islamic countries has to be viewed for what it is. It is an outlawed, small fraction of dissatisfied people who are taking advantage of international turbulent conditions to promote their own agenda.
And on that note, we are entirely out of time and we must end. And I thank you so very much, Dr. Kamal Karpat, for being with us today. We've learned a great deal about Turkey. And we, again, your lecture at 5:30 this evening, Dries Lab 113 on the OSU campus. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is listeners. Thank you. This is listener supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus. We're streaming live on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.